there. I'm Dr. Gabe Lowe, and welcome to the Hard Questions, No Answers podcast. This is a show that is less interested in answering life's difficult questions and more interested in the process of wrestling with them. This podcast is a forum to celebrate the messiness that makes us human. It is a place to invite the unanswerable questions because often it is precisely these types of questions that push us to dig deeper, to think harder, and to refine our approach to life. So, if you get to the end of the episode and you still have lots of questions, then I've done my job. I invite you on the pursuit of no answers. My guest today is Dr. Christine Nosegun, who is a board-certified licensed psychologist. I had the pleasure of meeting her while she was an associate professor at George Fox University, where she served as the director of the primary care track and the internship training director. In addition, she supervised doctoral students who provided clinical services to those attending Chamawa Indian School, as well as provided services through her own private practice. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Christine Nosegun. All right. Well, Dr. Christine Nosegun, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to have you on. I got to know you when I was doing my internship at George Fox University in Oregon, and you are, and as you were sort of telling me before we got started, you're transitioning out of the training director position for the internship program. And so that's where we got to know each other, and you helped guide us through that year-long process of getting our internship training. And the topic that you chose for us today is attachment theory. At this point, pretty ubiquitous within the psychological community. It's well-researched and it's got a lot of traction, but some people are probably not as familiar with psychological literature, might not necessarily know exactly what attachment means or attachment theory is. So do you mind just giving a brief sort of synopsis or definition of what attachment is?
Sure, absolutely, Gabriel. So really, you know, attachment is just the connectedness between humans. And typically when we think about attachment, we think about the early attachment. So when infants are attaching to their caregiver, whoever that might be. And then the way in which the caregiver responds to the infant really begins creating this idea for the infant of how to trust their caregiver, and then also how they can trust their surroundings. And what we find is a lot of those patterns repeat as they then go into adolescence and then even into adulthood and try to create attachments with a partner. And you really can see how these specific patterns play out over time, which is one reason why I find it so fascinating, because if we go back and look at some of those foundational pieces, it really can show us and reveal some of the distressing areas the individual might be experiencing.
Yeah, thank you. And you alluded to it a little bit already, but do you mind sharing a little bit about how you became exposed or interested to attachment theory, sort of how it became something that you took a deeper dive into?
Sure. Well, you know, one, I work a lot with children and adolescents. So a lot of times what I'm noticing in terms of just identity formation, they're trying to create their own friend groups and they're trying to figure out who they are while also being in a community with others, almost separating from family unit. Like, I know my role in the family, but there is just this real interesting time of development, which I find really fascinating. And then even early adulthood, you know, being able to see that. But I think what really sparked my interest was when I've been able to tie it to my own kind of story. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I can see how attachment also creates a sense of belonging or not, depending upon how that might play out. Mm-hmm. So that was really some of the main things. It's one, it's something we all experience, you know, in terms of attaching to something, someone. And a lot of the theories, you know, we're thinking, oh, it's more about feeding, you know, how the infant gets their basic needs. And they realized it's more than that, right? Like the Harlow with the Reese's monkeys. And how, you know, the monkey would cuddle with the terry cloth kind of model while reaching over and drinking, but it really was the comfort that they were seeking from the model rather than just the food, the basic needs. So
we
can't escape it. So I think it's something fascinating to look into when we work with individuals.
Yeah, yeah. And for those who aren't familiar with that study, you know, some might have predicted that the monkeys would gravitate towards, well, they set up two different fake mothers, and one having a cloth comforting sort of feel, and then the other one having food. And some might predict that the one that provides food is the more important monkey or fake monkey. But as they found, when the monkeys were distressed, they went to the cloth, the comfort it. And so that's sort of, I think, one of the most powerful pictures of what attachment is, that it isn't, as you were saying, just the basic physical needs, but there's also important emotional needs that go deeper beneath the surface.
Yes, and what's fascinating is if you Google it, you can find the original videos online. And it's just, it's funny to see some of those historical pieces and how they navigated them.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's ethics might be a little bit looser back then, but it's still, yeah, as you mentioned, very fascinating to see how it shaped our current ideas about how we attach to, you know, not, as you mentioned, not just caregivers, but also other people who play an important role in our life. So I'm curious, you know, who are some of the people in your life that you feel like have represented to you some of those attachment figures?
Absolutely. And as I'm describing this, another piece that I'm really interested in, I research a lot, is resilience and also ACEs, so adverse childhood experiences. And I can see how they all kind of come together. So as I describe it, you know, some of these other pieces are also going to be popping up.
Totally.
But where I grew up was, you know, rural southeastern Montana on a cattle ranch. So pretty isolated. And of course, you know, this, you know, being born in 78, you know, growing up in the 80s and the 90s, this was all pre-internet, cell phones. So a lot of just having to use your imagination or read books or something, but there really wasn't like TikTok that you could just lose yourself in.
Yeah.
And my dad was a ranch hand, so he was always out. So in the summer times, you know, he's
long
out
hours.
Yeah, long hours plowing the fields to create the hay that in the winter you feed the cattle. I mean, I didn't realize the process because I was just born into it. But yeah, it was all about taking good care of the cattle. And then my mom actually went back to school when I was young, but she traveled 70 miles one way with the majority of it on a dirt road and got her associate's degree and then went on from there. But at that point, she got a job. So, and then I'm the youngest of three siblings. So I have a sister who's 6 years older and a brother who's 4 years older. So there was a lot of just alone time, a lot of isolation. And then thinking about that attachment piece and how important it was. And then also, you know, generational trauma. Now that I know more about it, I could see how that also played a role in my family, where it really affects the ability to provide that comfort and attachment. Like with my mom, you know, my grandma was not a very kind, supportive, loving person to my mom. So then it was difficult for her to then be a kind, supportive, loving individual for us.
Yeah, it was sort of modeled.
Exactly. So I think in those early years, I found comfort really just being on a ranch, lots of animals, you know, lots of like horses and, you know, dogs and cats. But looking back, I can see how that need to have something to connect with was really important. And then also our problem-solving abilities, kind of our innate ability to be able to figure out what we need and how to get our needs met, which is really when we see problematic behaviors. Like, I think we can actually look at it from, there's a function to this behavior.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we don't have to just assume that somebody's behaviors are, you know, a symptom of pathology, but perhaps there's a real function to it. And maybe it could lead back to some of these earlier times when needs weren't being met. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then I was also mentioning that a part that, like, another twist to it is the fact that I grew up on, you know, right alongside the Northern Cheyenne Reservation. Mm-hmm. But I'm not an enrolled member, which means if you're not an enrolled member, you don't claim that you're Native. Is you just mm-hmm. don't. So then having to grow up in a space where, I mean, you don't necessarily belong mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. a way. And then growing up in a household where there really isn't secure, warm attachments, and how that can affect the ability to really question, you know, the why, right? Like, and I remember you were mentioning sometimes that you focus on questions that don't have answers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was a question that I had growing up, was why am I in a situation where I don't feel like I belong? Always feeling kind of like on the outside looking in, like I want to mm-hmm. join, I want to be a part of, but I'm not allowed for whatever reason. And how that affects identity formation and view of self and all of that.
Totally. Yeah. And I think I can relate on some level to that experience being Asian American, in the sense of sometimes I feel like I'm caught in between hanging out with other Asian people or white people, majority culture. And because I can relate to both, but then it sort of feels like I don't belong to either. That I'm not Asian enough for Asian people, or not white enough for white people. So it sounds like there was something similar for you of having this particular heritage, but also not being able to claim that kind of membership as other people who have shared that same heritage or background.
Absolutely. And that's exactly, even to this day, Gabriel, what it's like, where you don't mm-hmm. feel like you fit in anywhere. And I think, in one, I didn't realize, like, they talk about, you know, white privilege, you know, mm-hmm. growing up in just a very kind of bubble where, you know, the majority culture is Native. I didn't really realize there was the greater white majority, that because in my little bubble, job applications had written on there, you know, Native preference, you know, so my mm-hmm. world was very much the minority of a minority, but I didn't realize that until I actually left and got more removed. And, you know, Gabriel, what you described, I got like really like the biggest kind of realization is when I attended Montana State University Billings. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of just coming off of the reservation, and I'm going to this university, and there's, you know, like the Native group of students, but to them, mm-hmm. I'm a white girl. So I, you know, I'm not. And then there's like the white students, and I don't understand them. Like they don't make a lot of sense to me because I've never been around like majority white culture. Mm-hmm. And I actually found a student, she was just recently came from Japan. Mm-hmm. And so she also was displaced, and I felt displaced, yeah. And we found each other and became the best of friends. But it was my first real realization that I don't fit mm-hmm. anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, also when we talk about attachment theory, sort of implicit within that is this idea of internal working models, that the way that we behave and the way that we've been shaped sometimes is unconscious. It's below the surface, and we might not even be aware of the way that we respond to people because it's just normal. That's just how we've always behaved. And so I'm curious what that process was like for you, where you can look back now as an adult and see, hey, this is how I was shaped, or, you know, this is where I felt like I didn't belong. But what was that process like for you to start to come to awareness of how your background has shaped the way that you act as an adult?
I think actually when I had my children, it was one time mm-hmm. that the awareness began. Well, retrospectively, right? Because I actually had my first son when I was 18. Mm-hmm. I didn't, so I went literally from being under my parents' like rule as their child to now all of a sudden I have a child. Mm-hmm. And honestly, they threw the towel in on me at that point. They just figured, you know, you're going to be in our small town forever. You know, you're just going to be another, you know, put me in the box kind of mm-hmm. person. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, I knew I wanted more and mm-hmm. I didn't know how though. There really wasn't a path. And thinking about attachment, it was interesting because the world isn't a safe place. And I think that really goes back to that attachment piece, even being kind of in my home mm-hmm. and knowing now some of the generational trauma and the inability to create a warm, safe environment, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for my parents, for us as children, you know, with the world not being a safe place, it also means that you have to figure it out on your own. Totally. So you know, my mom's the kind of person where like, if it hits the fan, like she's going to be there. If mm-hmm. I ever needed to hide a body, like my mom would, you know, she, you
know, yeah, to the like, end I, of the earth.
Exactly.
Like, totally.
She's always there when there's a crisis, mm-hmm. which I'm so appreciative for, but just the secure basis that, you know, you're loved, you're cared for, everything is going to be okay. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. some of that just had to be from an innate, you got to know that you got this.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds like for your story, it was sort of a trial by fire that you just had to figure it out and there wasn't any way around it. And I don't know if this is sort of where you were going, but it sounds like when you really did need help, it sounds like your mom was one of those quote unquote secure bases for you, a place where you could go for support. And I'm sure a lot of parents can relate that when you have to parent, that takes a lot of energy. And sometimes it feels like you're giving, 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 and there's no place for you to go to get recharged. Would you say that your mom was that place for you to go? Or were there other people in your life that you felt like you really relied on at that point in time?
You know, I had a really great friend as well. And her mom was also a person of support. Mm. And I think, you know, with the different attachment styles, right? So we know that we have like the secure attachment, but there's also like the insecure avoidant, mm-hmm. the insecure resistant, the insecure disorganized. And those are all more the caregiver was either unavailable or rejecting, or they were inconsistent or even neglectful and abusive. And I think for me growing up, there was a lot of like that ambivalent that, mm-hmm. you know, not really knowing what you're going to get.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's where I think for my mom, and maybe dealing with her own stuff, maybe there was times when she could be more present mm-hmm. and maybe not. Of course, we don't have these talks.
Yeah.
You know, we don't talk about these things. If my mom even knew I was talking about this now, she would not be happy with me.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. you know, you just keep it in the family. You know, you don't mm-hmm, talk about mm-hmm. these things. You don't tell
yeah,
what's happening in the family. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It stays at home.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times when, you know, she rules with an iron fist and she, sure. you know, you don't really cross her. She'll go down swinging, even though she's in her early 60s. You
know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, my dad, he actually had a traumatic brain injury when he was in the military, when he was 18. Mm. And it really does feel like, you know, neurologically, he stopped at about age 18. I mean, mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. so just that silliness of life, that's kind of what he brings. So on the one hand, there's always like this lightheartedness, but there's times when you need a serious conversation or you need real help. So, you know, laughing and humor is a way that we deal with everything. But sometimes we just need to also talk about certain things too. Like not everything can be a joke. And he also was kind of like the henchman for my mom, where she would be the one, like, he would carry out the orders if it was discipline type of thing. So again, with the attachment, it was that ambivalence, right? Because you didn't really know. So there was a lot of unpredictability. And that affects, you know, your ability to attach securely, because you always assume that you never know what you're going to get. So it's hard to trust when what you've been taught to know is don't trust, because you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah. Yeah. That you're sort of always on guard to try to figure out what the appropriate response is. Like, do I go here or do I do here? Do, you know, what do I say? Because as you mentioned, you just never know what end of the stick you're going to get. And so it sounds like, you know, as you look back on these things, you can sort of see some of those patterns. Would you say that when you became a parent, did you see a lot of those same patterns coming out in you? Or were you very intentional about, hey, I want to do things different from the way that I was raised? You know, what was sort of that experience for you being a new mom?
Well, in my mind, I was like, I'm going to do things different, right? Like, it's going to be different. But what's fascinating kind of retrospectively is, you don't know what to do. I mean, yes, I want to do something different, but what is that something?
Yeah. What are my options?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And, you know, outside of my home environment, it was still very ambivalent, because being a minority, you know, you're told like, hey, that person over there wants to fight you, or these, you know, there's a lot of violence and, you know, poverty and substance use. And so it was unpredictable in and outside of my home. So even in terms of who can I model to, in terms of my own parenting, I actually did not have a different way of being until I came to George Fox as a student. And that was when I have a mentor, her name's Dr. Hamilton here, who now we're colleagues. But it wasn't until she really provided like a secure attachment and a different way of being that I'd never actually observed before. And from that, I was able to kind of model and do different things, because now I had a different way. When, you know, because even with my best friend since we were five, and, you know, her household was very, very different, not near as cold or anything like that, but they're just as screwed up too, right? Like,
totally.
I mean, we're kind of all cut from the same cloth. We're a community of like 500 people in rural Montana. Sure, like, we're all kind of cut from the same
cloth. Pretty insular.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was hard to really find somebody outside that could provide different ways of doing things. And I didn't realize I needed it. I didn't realize, you know, because again, it's all around, very insular, like you said. So you don't really know what's happening.
Yeah.
That's not maybe the healthiest way of living.
And you don't know what you don't know. That, as you mentioned, you can say, hey, I want to do things different. But if you don't have any framework for anything else, then it's hard to just be creative and pull something out of thin air, and who knows if that's going to work.
Exactly, like watching TV shows and you see these families and you're like, yes, that looks good, but
sure,
how do you do that for the long term?
Totally. I think one thing that I find very compelling and I think helpful about attachment theory is the idea that when you do have a secure base, as you mentioned, Dr. Hamilton was that for you, that what that does for you is it allows you to take risks. It allows you to sort of go outside your comfort zone because you know that even if that risk goes wrong, you have somewhere to return to, you have somewhere to feel safe again. And I feel like that's sort of the balance between two options that on the one hand, you can be very risk averse of, hey, I don't want to make a mistake, so I'm just going to play it safe all the time. Or, you know, there are other people who just, everything's a risk to them and they will just, they can be very stimulus seeking or excitement seeking, that they're looking for that excitement. Did you notice any of those patterns, especially with Dr. Hamilton being sort of that secure base for you? Did you notice your approach to life changing in any of those ways?
I noticed my approach changing in the fact that I began healing from some of the wounds of my past. Yeah. The part that's always been a wonder to me is where the resilience came from, because my family of origin, especially in the greater, you know, friend group that's still considered family because they're close. When I decided that I wanted to go on to get my doctorate, you know, people weren't supportive. I mean, people from my hometown, it's more common to not graduate from high school than it is to go on and get a doctorate degree. So it's very, very uncommon. My mom did support that. Everyone else always kind of laughed at me. And then some flat out said I would never succeed. And I really didn't know how. You know, I just kind of fumbled my way around. And even my institution, when I asked them, how do I go on? Because we had a master's program, but not a doctorate program. So when I asked, like, how do I go on to get my doctorate? They actually gave me a book of all of the graduate programs in the nation. And I was like, okay. So I went home and—
like
and
a phone book.
Right, exactly. And I'm like, well, okay. And I went home and asked my husband, where would you like to live? And he said, I've always heard Oregon was nice. So I opened up a book and I said, well, we have Pacific University and George Fox University. And that's how I got to George Fox. I didn't even realize it was a Christian university until I needed a pastor's reference.
Sure.
Because you know, there was like zero guidance. So I feel like something internally was pulling me. And helping me be resilient to overcome these adverse experiences. That was the part that I've never really understood. And also like the why me. A lot of survivor's guilt as well. You know, like my BFF that I was mentioning, she's still at home with her mom. And yeah, just a lot of heartache that she's experienced and a lot of sorrow. And so I wonder, like, how did I get here? You know, how did I become a board certified licensed psychologist who's able to be doing a podcast with a previous intern who's very successful himself, right? Like, this doesn't happen.
Like you sort of trailblazed in a lot of ways that you didn't have those models. And it sounds like there were some perhaps providential things going on behind the scenes.
Perhaps. I mean, I don't know what else it would be. And then, but even being here, that in terms of attachment and belonging, my very first class. So mind you, I was 29 when I came into the program and left Montana to be here, you know, from the reservation, haven't been beyond the reservation. And now all of a sudden I'm in George Fox University, which there's not a lot of people from the res that go to school here, right? It's, you know,
totally. And
the first class, I'm so excited. I'm here, right? Like I made it, I'm here. And I pull out my notebook and I pull out my pen. And I'm like, let's do this. And everyone else pulls out laptops.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you know, one of the first classes, they're talking about how God has all of our names on the palm of his hand. And I remember raising my hand saying, I have my boys' names tattooed on my back. And at that time, there was an audible gasp. Like my classmates, like, oh. And I'm like, where am I? Like, oh my gosh.
Totally. Yeah. And it sounds like that school experience all over again, where you feel like the odd one out. And I mean, I'll let you speak for yourself. Did it feel like, you know, here I go again with that lack of belonging? Like, I don't know how to relate to my classmates.
I did. But you know, Gabriel, honestly, it wasn't that awareness, like, here I am again, because again, this has been life, right? Like, I haven't ever had a spot where I felt like I fit in or I belonged. It was just okay, figure this out quickly. How do I navigate this? My fear was, I mean, because, you know, I had an accent that I really worked on hard, and to not sound different. Phenotypically, I look like everyone. So if I can just not say anything, you know, maybe then they won't find out that I really shouldn't be here.
Yeah, you just blend in.
Just blend in, right? Like, just hide. The, you know? And again, like with my mom, remember, if there's a crisis, you can call her. Mm-hmm. Mom, I need a laptop. Everyone has a laptop. I'm the only one without a laptop. And you know, like, help me.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I was able to just, and this is the hard part, Gabriel, is I was able to basically figure out how to be a professional, which meant a middle-class white person, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. That was the model.
So if I completely disown this whole part of who I am, and act like everyone here, I will belong enough. And really, I didn't think I was even going to ever get here. I didn't think I was ever going to get my doctorate. So I couldn't rock the boat. You know, I couldn't make waves. I just had to put my head down and do what I needed to do. I could get the degree and then go wherever I was supposed to go after that.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And so I'm curious, you know, because my experience of you and as limited as that was that 1 year, you know, I wouldn't consider you to be an insecure person or somebody who doesn't take ownership of their identity. You know, where do you think that came from in terms of being able to own your successes, but at the same time, being able to reclaim that identity and that you aren't a white middle-class person, that you have other aspects of your story that don't conform to perhaps majority culture or other sort of experiences?
Well, I think transitioning to a different job altogether is part of that journey, honestly. I think that's a big part. And just in conversations, I've heard people say, you know, COVID has really caused us to reassess our values. And I'm wondering if that might be a part of this as well. But then again, you know, because I'm not an enrolled member, I identify as, well, I used to identify as a white girl. I guess now it's a white woman. You know, I'm in my 40s now. But but again, even going to Chamawa, you know, I'm still not an enrolled tribal member. So I can't say that I'm a Native American, you know. And my family history, like, I know my grandparents, my great grandparents immigrated from Hungary, you know, like fleeing Hitler and all of that. Like, I know bits and pieces of things, but I don't really know who I am, even at this point.
Sure.
I haven't found a place where I fit.
Yeah. And that goes back again to what we're talking about of there might not be easy or nice, neat little answers, and that this is, as it's been for you, a lifelong journey.
It has. And it's hard to believe that at this point I am considered middle age, which makes sense though, because that would be 84. But sure. Yes, so like half of my life, so to speak, of... which I think, Gabriel, is one reason why attachment is something that really resonates with me, is I've never really felt that sense of belonging. I think the family that I have, like with my husband and my children, you know, is kind of a family unit that we've created. But even my oldest son, who's 23 now, has had a lot of struggles. So in terms of my parenting and my like attachment that I'm providing for them, and my own trauma and, you know, generational trauma, and then my specific trauma, then I just assume, well, I'm the one who messed up the attachment with him, you know, and I think about those things. And he has a 3-year-old daughter, and I'm trying to, you know, kind of repair ruptures that I think may have happened as well. But he's also very dark skin, and we brought him to a very white community. So there was just a sense of belonging that he didn't have. Like, we kind of took him out of the reservation where he had a sense of belonging to a white community. So it disrupted that. And then, you know, I have another son who's more like, well, I call him my mocha, my caramel, and my vanilla latte. You know, I feel like that kind of how they
are. Yeah. Your color palette.
Exactly. And I love coffee, so it works very well.
Yeah.
And I've also noticed that, like, with my, like, I've changed over the years, and then my husband has changed. So as I've been able to heal, and really, I feel like with, like, we were going back to Dr. Hamilton, she provided that secure attachment because there was this non-judgmental, you know, if we go person-centered lingo, you know, unconditional positive regard about her, that she was very accepting of me, even though I wasn't this, you know, kind of image I was trying to, or, you know, mold myself into. And she herself grew up in Nigeria because her parents were missionaries. So she understood what it was like to not, you know, to not really fit in either. And she continues to be, you know, I mentioned before, that ambivalent attachment where you never know what you're going to get. I've known her now for like 12 years, and she's always been consistent. So she's has given me this other piece of the story that I've never experienced before.
What we in the biz might call a reparative relationship or reparative experience.
Absolutely. I like that. What we in the biz might call. Yes, is exactly right.
I think one thing that's interesting about your story is the way that you talk about healing, but at the same time, this desire for belonging hasn't gone away. Because I think a lot of people who can relate to your story might feel like, you know, when I'm healed, I will feel like I belong, or that belonging is somehow necessary for my healing. But it sounds like in your case that, you know, people like Dr. Hamilton give you some sense of belonging, but at the same time, there have been some aspects of that longing that haven't fully gone away. So I'm curious how you conceptualize and how you sort of understand that part of your experience of, you know, what does healing mean if it doesn't mean a taking away of that longing or a sense of belonging?
No, such a great question, Gabriel. And I think what I'm taking, you know, and trying to even maybe demonstrate is the fact that, you know, even from a biblical sense, we live in a fallen world. So nothing is ever going to be perfect. And I can be healed, meaning that I can feel that I am good enough, even if I don't have a place where I fit. And I think that that can be okay. And there might be times when I mourn that there's no place for me to fit, but I know that I can mourn. I know how to mourn, and I know that it's appropriate to do so. So rather than making it an inward, what's wrong with me? Why don't I fit in? I can have that level of acceptance that this is what it is. And for whatever reason, this is my journey. And when I do face hardships, whether it be with, you know, my kids or, you know, clients, you know, anything, I just remind myself that this is my journey, that for whatever reason I'm walking on, and these are the lessons that I should be learning on this journey, and it's unique to me. So for me, healing is just being able to have self-compassion and self-love. regardless if I, you know, fit into a mold or not. And I don't have to fit in to still be good enough as a whole person.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. You know, I think that definitely makes a lot of sense. And I think that helps to frame it in a sense of what does healing actually mean? You know, that can mean so many different things for different people. But, you know, I think the piece that you're hitting at is this piece of how you relate to yourself and how you choose to sort of see yourself. I think another aspect that makes this really challenging, and you've touched on it a little bit already, but this aspect of trauma, and you mentioned ACEs, which it just stands for adverse childhood experiences. And yet another thing in our field that has gotten a lot of traction recently and continues to be explored and understood and researched. And basically, you know, the research behind it, this huge Kaiser study that took a look at thousands of individuals and basically saw a huge amount of impacts on physical health as it relates to some of these early childhood adverse experiences. And so, you know, I want to explore with you a little bit about navigating this challenge of, on the one hand, there is this conscious effort that needs to be made, as you mentioned, of being able to treat yourself with self-compassion and being able to sort of separate out the aspects that you're responsible for versus the things that you don't need to beat yourself up for or beyond your control. And part of that beyond your control piece is some of that childhood trauma, which unfortunately a lot of people can relate to. And so I want to ask you, how have you sort of looked at ACEs or trauma in terms of trying to, and you're also a clinical practitioner, you know, how have you either for yourself or with patients helped to try to disentangle that trauma in terms of what is your personal responsibility and what is the stuff that, you know, was done to you that you can sort of let go of?
Something that I've noticed working with children and adolescents is, you know, we need to make sense of our world so that we can understand it and then just move on. And without really, you know, fully developed frontal lobes, you know, we just assume that we are the problem. You know, so whatever happens around me or to me is because of me. And then we really begin to develop this hindered view of self that, you know, I'm not good enough or I'm a problem, I'm a burden or whatever. And that's the piece that I try to disentangle when I'm working with trauma. And it can be so incredibly difficult because now it's a lens in which they see everything, right? You know, the confirmation bias, which is we only seek out information that will prove what we believe to be truth. So if I feel that I suck, I'm only going to seek out people that confirm that belief. And I'm only going to listen to comments that tell me that. And, you know, I will tell my patients, if there was a room of 100 people and 99 were telling you that you're amazing and one person was telling you that you suck, which one would you listen to? I go, well, I would listen to that one person because that's the belief I hold about myself. So I'm only going to be attuned to them. So trying to help them be able to shift how they view themselves. Because we see this in so many ways. Now, the partners or the friends that they choose, again, are going to be those same patterns of behaviors being repeated. And when all you've known is maybe dysfunction and toxic relationships, that's what you're going to seek out because it's familiar and it's comfortable. And to even demonstrate this, it's fascinating. I have a patient now and has had, you know, horrible relationships in the past that have created this view of self that's very hindered and hurtful. We've worked on that aspect, you know, of who she is. And as she began healing, she began looking for different people to date. And then she actually is dating somebody who's very different from the men that she's dated in the past. Yeah. And there are times when she's almost sabotaged that relationship with him because he wasn't responding the way in which everyone else has responded in these situations. So it was really uncomfortable for her because it was unfamiliar. So even dysfunction can be very comforting because we know the rules of the game. We know how we're going to be treated. Exactly. We know what to expect. And if we take that back to attachment, it almost creates a secure attachment because if anything, we know what to expect. Not that it's healthy, but it's predictable. And that unpredictability can really just keep people, you know, they're not on stable ground. So at least if I'm being abused, I know the cycle of abuse, or at least if I'm being neglected or whatever. So that's a piece that I really try to target when I'm disentangling trauma, and then help them be able to take a step back. And as we kind of review, process the traumatic experience, for them to be able to see how these messages or behaviors were imposed onto them, not that they were deserving of it, and not that, you know, they did anything, but to try to help them take a step back and pull themselves out of that situation so that they can see it from a different perspective. But it's a, as you know, it is a process, and it's a hard process.
Yeah.
And it affects the way they see everything. And it takes a lot of work to be able, well, one, for them to even give themselves permission to perhaps feel like they deserve to be loved or treated well.
Even though it can feel discouraging at times, I think it really helps to clarify why some of these patterns repeat. You know, you would expect that we want what's good for us, or we pursue things that are good for us, but that's not always the case. And I'm sure that most people can think of times where they've gone to something familiar that's ultimately worse in the long run, but, you know, there's a reason behind it. It's not because you're sadistic or masochistic. It's because there are certain things that you're getting from that experience beyond just the end result. And you know, I think that it can feel so uncomfortable to experience something different because you don't know what to expect. And I think some people even take it a step further and become anxious. Well, what if I lose this good thing? What if I'm disappointed by this thing? This thing that's the best thing I've experienced thus far in my life. You know, I think another thing that people struggle with, and you've gone through, is becoming a parent. And I've heard so many parents say, you know, I'm so anxious about screwing my kid up or doing the wrong thing. And you know, how have you sort of navigated that anxiety that parents typically have of recognizing this immense responsibility, taking a look at your history and saying, hey, these are all the things that I want to do differently, but at the same time, I'm scared I'm going to make a mistake. How have you dealt with that, either in your own life or with patients?
In my own life, I dealt with it by admitting when I'm wrong and saying that I'm sorry, and just, you know, accepting my faults and my shortcomings, and being okay with it. And that's something that I have found can be really healing for that rupture and repair piece, is just being able to call it out. And that's something that some parents struggle with, my own parents struggle with, but just being told that, you know, I'm sorry, I did wrong you, or that was, you know, whatever the thing is, but to be able to be humble in the fact that, yes, I'm the parent, but I don't have all the answers and I'm going to screw up and I can admit it when I am wrong and have that conversation. And it can also model for my children that, one, it's okay to be wrong And it's important to acknowledge it. It's important to accept it, because I think at that point we can learn from it. Because if we always have to be right, then there's no room to grow. And I'm still growing every day in terms of everything that I do. So I think that's been the way that I've navigated it the most, is just being willing to accept when I've done something, even if I didn't mean to, but maybe it was hurtful or whatever. And just being able to say, yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think part of the fear is that if I admit I'm wrong, I'm going to lose respect or I'm going to lose control in some way. But the irony is that it's the opposite, that when you are able to admit that you're wrong, that strengthens your relationship with the other person, because they can see, they know you're wrong. You know, you don't have to tell them.
I see it.
Yeah, I know. And kids will call you out.
Yes.
But you know, it's about meeting that emotional need. It's not about the cognitive need of keeping order, law and order, but it's about that, as you mentioned, the rupture and repair, that there are going to be ruptures, that that's inescapable, but it's what you do with those ruptures to repair the relationship.
Absolutely. And I think it takes a lot of strength to admit when you're wrong. Because your ego has to be able to withstand the fact that you're not always right. And that can be really difficult for people. And I've seen, you know, clients really just do the power over with their kiddos. Like, I'm the parent, I'm what's right. And it's just enforcing their power, when it just creates a lot of that rupture and headbutting, because now the child, like you said, they see it. They know that you're wrong. So you're not gaining anything by forcing them just to be quiet about
So another word that you used and have been talking about throughout your story is this one of resilience. And I think that that's an attractive word for a lot of us, that we want to be able to think of ourselves as resilient, and that we want to be able to have it, especially in this day and age of COVID, where it feels like, you know, we're constantly being worn down, either by the situations or just being, you know, keeping our family afloat. And so I'm curious what that word has grown to mean for you over time, because, you know, I think just like any of the other words like trauma or attachment, it can mean different things to different people. But I'm curious sort of how that word has sort of gained meaning for you over time.
Sure. And put simply, just the ability to bounce back after something negative has happened, you know, just being able to pick yourself up and keep pushing forward. And it's definitely been one of my big areas of topic for research. So I've done a lot of research, and what I found is that it just takes one person to care about you for you then to believe that you're worthy of being cared for, and then you can care for yourself. So that in those moments, you feel like you had the ability to pick yourself back up and move forward. And I have found, like, when going through the grad program, you know, kudos to my husband, because there were so many times where I feel like he was wrapping me up with duct tape and sending me back out there. And that's how it felt. Sure. Like, pieces are falling apart. Like, I can't do this. And, you know, we had three children at the time and we're living on student loans, and, you know, life is so hard. And I'm like, oh, and, you know, just having him be there to say, you can do this, and being there to totally take care of the kiddo. So he was a stay-at-home dad. And he got a lot of pushback from his family, actually, for being a stay-at-home dad. But we had three kiddos. So, you know, somebody had to be able to be the caregiver. So he was willing to do that so I could focus just on school. And as you know, Gabriel, getting a doctorate, it's no joke.
It's a marathon.
It is. And what we're sprinting through the marathon. There's just never ending. There's always something that needs to be done, and it can always be bigger and better. And you're trying to keep up with your cohort mates and, you know, yes, just lots and lots. And it can really take a toll. So I, just to give an example of that one person to help, I think that really can demonstrate how he just clearing the path so I could focus and giving me the reassurance that I can do this allowed me then to go to school and keep fighting the good fight. And you know, another thing was the sense that that belonging piece even was being with cohort members who, like, because we're from poverty, you know, nothing about here represents who we are back home. And being around fellow students who, you know, have Louis Vuitton bags, you know, the big bags too.
Yeah.
Little coin purses, but the big bags.
Yeah. Can't miss it.
Yeah, you know, you cannot miss it. And they don't want you to either. But having to tell myself, I am across the table from them, which means I'm just as deserving to be at the table as they are, and convince myself that I'm not less than just because I don't have these things. I don't have these luxuries. I don't have, you know, we are living on financial aid. We are on food stamps, you know, and we're scraping together, but I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I belong here. I've earned my right to be here. But these were actual conversations I would have with myself while sitting across the table from these students. And I think that it really shows the reflection of the conversations I was having at home that then I was able to bring to school with me to really help demonstrate if one person cares about us, that we can believe that we're worthy enough to care about ourselves, and then we can keep pushing forward.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. You know, I think that as you mentioned, this is a lifelong process. It's constantly, you know, a daily thing of being kind to yourself and being willing to recognize your own limitations. And I think that for a lot of us who are listening to this podcast, there's probably been some work done, but it's an ongoing thing. And I think that, you know, for somebody who's just starting out to do some of this exploration, self-exploration, it can be a daunting task. And I think as you have alluded to, and as I can certainly attest to, it can be a deconstructive process in a lot of ways to look back at your history and say, hey, that sucked. You know, that the way that I was brought up is not the way that I want to continue to lead my life. It can be hard if you don't have some of those models. So I'm curious what kinds of things you would share to somebody in the midst of that journey of, you know, what does it take and how do you go through that deconstruction process in a healthy way? How do you allow yourself to do some of that exploration without being overwhelmed or without feeling like it's too much?
Well, and before we want to deconstruct anything, there has to be healthy coping. You know, we have to have something that we can utilize as we're feeling, you know, kind of stirred up, tore apart, broke down a little bit. And you know, some people do have like unhealthy ways of coping. But again, like I said earlier, there's a function to our behaviors. There's a reason why we're using this. So what I would suggest really is, how do you take care of yourself? And I'm a huge advocate for like positive psychology. And, you know, some people say, oh, clinicians shouldn't be cheerleaders, but I really just feel that every person is just such an amazing, you know, like they have so many amazing qualities, but they're just like tarnished, right? They just need to be kind of taken off the shelf and polished up a little bit. So what I would kind of give to anyone who's just beginning this journey is one, is just to recognize their own personal strength. Because when you actually take pause and look at where you've come from, what you've done to get to where you are at this point in this exact moment, you will see a story of strength and resilience, because life is hard. And, you know, Plato said my favorite quote, which is, "Be kind, for we're all fighting a great battle." And I do believe that to be true. And if we actually allow ourselves to recognize how we've overcome the battles that we've overcome just on a daily basis, mm-hmm. we can already begin to recognize the amazing strength that we have, and the endurance and the grit and the perseverance, literally just to wake up the next day and do that day, mm-hmm. Takes so much strength. So to start with a place where you're deserving to mm-hmm. do things better because you want to do things better, or you know, there's things in your life that you don't appreciate or they're hurting you and you want to change. But I really feel we have to start with a place that you're worthy and you're deserving, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, we have ourself. And if we can't take care of ourself, then, you know, it's going to be difficult to put in the work, because we're not going to feel that we deserve to put in the work. We're not going to feel we deserve to be a priority, you know. And so many times we have parents or clients or caregivers who won't make themselves a priority. They feel like that's being selfish. And then, you know, like when we're on a plane, what do they say? Put the air mask on yourself before you put it on others. Why do we do that? If you don't take care of you and put that mask on you, you're not going to be able to help anyone, because
it's impossible. You're not going
to be- Exactly.
Yeah.
So just to really try to pour into people and allow them to look at themselves from perspectives mm-hmm. that maybe they've never considered or allowed themselves to, and actually have the conversation about, can you allow yourself to see, you know, what an amazing individual you are? And then to look at the function behind the behaviors rather than mm-hmm. these are ways that I can beat myself up. Look at the reason, like the why behind. And when people recognize the why, then they can do something different. But it's so often that people don't trust themselves because, you know, they don't recognize their, you know, the reason behind why they're doing what they're doing. So now they just feel mm-hmm. unpredictable. So that's a long way to say, and not a very a long and not very clear way to say, to answer your question, Gabriel.
I mean, I think there's a lot of good nuggets in that. And I think that those who might say that people don't need a cheerleader might be speaking from a certain level of privilege, where they might not necessarily be relating to people who are in the midst of that battle. You know, we, as you mentioned, we all have that battle going on, but I think there are different times where that battle is more oppressive, and when that battle is, you know, really toll on us, and we need somebody to come alongside and say, "Hey, you're worth fighting for."
I think that's so well said, Gabriel. Like, we can see it from a place of privilege. Like, yeah, you don't need a cheerleader. That's why you don't feel it's necessary, because you probably have many people or somebody in your life who served that role for you. And mm-hmm. and I so agree that some people just need to know they are worth fighting for. And I feel honored to be able to be the person who can say that to somebody who's struggling mm-hmm. so that they feel that they can get up and do another day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we're wrapping up here, but as we're sort of finishing, I think again, you know, for those who might be listening and feeling like, hey, you know, I want to do this hard work, and it is hard work to look at your own attachment, the attachments that you have, or even just internally sort of the patterns that have played out. And as both of us would attest, a good place to do that is in therapy, in psychotherapy. Do you mind just sort of sharing a little bit about what to look for? You know, because I think that a lot of people can come to the point of, you know, we might say contemplative stage, you know, where they're like, okay, I want to do something about it, but it can be very intimidating or overwhelming. And especially in this day and age where it can feel like looking through a phone book, just like when you were trying to find a school. There's so many options out there, or, you know, I don't know what the best option for me is. You know, what would you say to somebody who's trying to take that first step?
Well, one is, just because you're with a therapist does not mean that they might be the best fit for you. And that's something that I even teach my students that I supervise, is, you know, there's so many different people in the world that it's about fit. Because really, if you're going to a therapist, you have to trust them. Because if you don't trust them, you're not going to do the work that needs to be done, because you won't be able to open up and really get to those painful places that you need to heal from. You're going to be guarded all the time. And at that point, it really is just kind of a waste of time, and maybe even money as well. So if you feel like this is somebody that you can trust, you know, try it out. And if you're somebody who needs to know who the person is sitting across from you, you know, you can ask questions, and how the therapist responds, you know, maybe that'll be a positive or not. But I feel like whatever it is that you need to do to feel like it's a safe place. And we do a lot of teaching on trauma-informed care. And the first thing is creating a safe place. And if you don't have that, you're not going to get the biggest benefit out of that experience. And to encourage people to be okay with changing the therapist, and not saying, oh, look it, I can't even do therapy, and, you know, letting it be another way. Exactly. Like not beating yourself up over it, but having someone that you feel comfortable with. Because if you feel like this is someone that you can trust, they can hold that space, you're going to be able to go to those really deep, dark places. And those are the places that are the deep wounds that we need to be able to bring to the light and clean and cleanse and heal from.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. You know, we barely touched the surface of what attachment theory is, but, you know, I think I really appreciate you sharing, you know, your own personal journey with us.
Well, Gabriel, such a pleasure. I'm just so proud and happy for you. You know, from being an intern to where you are now, it's just so great to see. So thank you for asking me to come on your podcast. And I do apologize that I didn't spend a ton of time about the theory. I mean, we didn't talk about Ainsworth's strain.
We could have gone so deep into it, but
we could have. We didn't.
That might have just been us nerding out.
Exactly. So yeah. I hope this could be a beneficial talk for your listeners. But if anything, it was just so good to see you today.
Yeah, you too. Thank you for tuning in to the Hard Questions, No Answers podcast. Still have questions? Oh, good. I was afraid we answered them all. For more information about the HQ&A podcast, visit drgabelow.com. That's drgabelow.com. Additional educational materials recommended by my guests can be found in the podcast tab. And for the updates, news, and behind the scenes, follow HQ&A Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at HQ&A Pod. HQ&A Podcast is independently produced by Gabriel Lowe. Music is Cocktail Fun by Stock Music 331, found on Pond 5. And logo design is by Kenny Lowe. Stay tuned for new episodes released each Wednesday. And thank you for joining me on the journey of No Answers.